should be on.
Good evening.
Yeah.
Well, welcome to the Dallas Philosophers Forum. We're glad that you came out on a really chilly night. And it's always a little bit, we have a bit of anxiety sometimes to know, you know, what the audience is going to be like. So we're glad that you came. Especially our group from Midwestern State that drove all the way from Wichita Falls, and they started coming regularly last fall, and in the fall we were starting at 7 p.m., and we've gone back to our old time 7:30, but I guess they didn't get the message, so they've been here for quite a while. We appreciate that. So, and how many first-time attendees do we have that are just... All right, terrific. That's great. Well, welcome. We're glad that you're here. We meet every second and fourth Tuesday of the month here at El Phoenix. And so if you go to our website, which is philosophersforum.org, there's a lecture schedule. And hopefully the dates and the information on that will get you here for the topic that you thought you were going to hear. We're a nonprofit organization. So we do charge a small fee for your attendance, which is $5. And Rob, who is our president, is our acting treasurer this evening. So if you got in and you didn't pay your $5, we'd appreciate the funds. Now, we have a really good deal for those that come. You know, you just really like philosophy and you want to come to every single meeting. If you want the best deal in Dallas, for almost half price, $35, you get to come for 6 contiguous months. Okay, so that there's a little bit of a qualification there that you've got to come to consecutive meetings. But other than that, it's a great deal. Okay. Please remember to pay your food bill. And I'll probably remind you one more time after the meeting is over. But if you don't pay, then your other friends and guests end up paying for your meal because it comes out of our funds because they do want their money. And I believe, I think the gratuity is now included, is that right?
Yeah, yeah.
So, I mean, if you want to add something beyond that, it's up to you, but I think the gratuity is added to your checks. Just wanted to point that out. If you would please silence your cell phones, turn them off or put them on vibrate, we'd really appreciate it. I know David, you know, he's a pretty strong guy, but, you know, competing with other topics tonight is probably not what he came to do. So, with that, are there any other announcements?
I've got copies.
We have copies of our program for the spring, so if you would like to have a printed copy, you'll see Rob after the meeting. He's got several copies. And I know he'd be glad to give you one. We also actually have business cards now, and the business cards don't have anyone's name on there, so if you would like to have a couple, 2 or 3 business cards, because you might actually tell someone about the Philosopher's Forum and might want to invite them, you could give them that card, and it's got the information about our organization and when we meet and so forth. All right, well, I would like to jump right in and introduce our speaker, who is no stranger to this group. David Drum has been a member of the Dallas Philosophers Forum for a long, long time. And I know when I first started coming, David was treasurer 3 or 4 years in a row before he became president. And that's really after we kind of stopped meeting for a while. And David was the impetus behind us reorganizing and kind of getting started back. And he was a terrific leader in making that happen. And he was gracious enough tonight to be our kind of surrogate speaker. Dave, not saying that that you're any less than the speaker of the schedule, but as happens to us periodically, someone that didn't check their schedule or something came up and they can't come, and David agreed to fill in tonight. But he's not your average fill-in because he has a bachelor's degree from the University of Texas at Austin in anthropology. Correct. And he went to SMU Law, and he's a partner in the Dallas law firm Carrington Coleman, and they have a couple of other names that I don't remember what those are, so I won't, you know, can't say that. He has a very interesting topic tonight, but it's kind of got a long title, so I had to look that up. He's going to speak to us about the burgeoning resurgence of Aristotle's notions of formal and final causation, which is a different topic in spite of what this says over here. No, actually not. All right. With that, I give you David Grove.
Thank you, Jack. That is my title. I just kind of had a simplified little heading here for the next few slides. My interest in this topic is relatively recent, and really is sparked by a confluence of references in some recent reading material that I'll share with you as you go along. I had been familiar with Aristotle's notion of four causes for some time, just based on background reading and history of philosophy and so forth, but it didn't really catch my interest in any significant way. It seemed to me for a while just to be a historical relic of kind of an outdated explanation of things that had been much more succinctly summarized by Newtonian science and subsequent science, and so I didn't really have any particular affinity for this subject. But then I began to come across more and more references in different materials to these notions. Three main ones I'm going to talk about tonight are from the standpoint mostly of formal cause. Rupert Sheldrake, who is from Oxford, has written several books, but this particular one is called The Presence of the Past, The Habits of Nature, about morphic resonance, and draws in references to Aristotle's notion of formal cause very liberally in his explanation. The book I'll probably make reference to the most is one I also used some materials out of in my last talk before the forum. Terence W. Deacon is an anthropologist and neuroscientist and the chair of anthropology at University of California, Berkeley. And this book, Incomplete Nature, was published last year in 2012, and covers a wide variety of subjects from thermodynamics to zombies and golems, to homunculi, to the concept of work and information and sentience and consciousness and agency and significance, and all from a scientific standpoint, and so I found this very interesting, but he uses Aristotle's notions of causation as one of his primary organizational materials to really organize his own theory around, which I found interesting. And then, thirdly, I've spoken to this group about integral theory. One of the more recent integral theory books is not by Ken Wilber, but by another integral writer named Steve McIntosh, called Evolution's Purpose, an Integral Interpretation of the Scientific Story of Our Origins. And it also has a little chart in here on the four causes that I'll put up on a slide a little later. And he also uses the notion of Aristotle's four causes as a primary organizational rubric for his ideas. And so when I kept seeing this reference come up in these different sources, it caused me to kind of want to reflect a little bit more and figure out what this is all about. So I went back to my Copleston History of Philosophy. I have the ideas of Aristotle's causes emerged from his physics and his metaphysics. And I will confess that I have not read the physics and the metaphysics through in their entirety, but have read quite a bit about these notions, and so I'll be primarily drawing from Copleston. So I thought what I would do for the talk is start with an analysis of the four kinds of causation in the schema of Aristotle, the way he uses it for the first part of the talk, and then for the second part of the talk, talk about the way that these concepts were used in original Newtonian physics, and then the third part would be then to talk about what I call this burgeoning resurgence, about how these concepts are being revitalized and found to have some meaning after all. One of the things about Aristotle is that a lot of things in his theory have proven to be just flat wrong. And so it's kind of hard to be an Aristotelian, you know, in the classic sense of following all of the theory, because, you know, it just doesn't quite work all the way. But what I've discovered is that by making some translations, or perhaps even some going a little bit deeper to the kernel of some of these ideas, there is still power in the ideas and the notions, even if some of the specific references that Aristotle made of them are not compatible with scientific research. So let's talk about the four causes as Aristotle presented them. Aristotle believed that the most noble person of a human being, most noble purpose of a human being, which he called the rational animal. That was his way of distinguishing humans from other animals, is that humans had this rational faculty. And so the most noble purpose of a human being was to use this rational faculty to understand the causes of events. And he thought it was more noble to understand a cause in the theoretical sense, for knowing for the sake of knowing, than it was to understand something for a pragmatic or a practical benefit, you know, in order to make an invention or, you know, fly to the moon or something like that. That was okay, but that really wasn't the highest and best, you know, of humanity. The highest and best was to know the reasons for something for their own sake. And so he's very interested in causes or reasons for phenomena. And he said there were four different causes that were necessary to explain, you know, what shows up in our experience. The first one I'll talk about is material cause. The way Aristotle thought of this kind of causation is that it was a basic substratum out of which a substance, which is a good Aristotelian word, is composed. To Aristotle, the basic thing in the universe he called a substance. But a substance was a union of two different components. There was a material component, which is this substratum, the stuff out of which it's made, and there's a formal component, which is the organization or the pattern embodied by the thing. And so you could sort of think of Play-Doh and taking a mold. You know, the Play-Doh would be the material cause. The mold would be the formal cause that imposes a form or an order on the material. To Aristotle's way of thinking, this material cause was the source of individuality, subjectivity, and potentiality. Aristotle thought it was better to be actual than potential, and that the direction of movement was toward the actualization of potentialities. And so this material substrate to him existed in potential and needed to be actualized by the activity of these other causes. And although the Greeks thought in terms of four kinds of material, air, fire, water, and earth, which Aristotle took over from the pre-Socratics, Aristotle believed all four were reducible to what he called prime matter, which cannot exist apart from form, as we just said, and it's therefore unknowable in itself. You could never find an example of prime matter without form, because all matter is in fact form. So examples of this material cause would be in a sculpture, if the sculptor works on the marble, the marble would be the material cause of what the sculpture is, because the sculpture wouldn't be what it is without that material. And that's part of what it is. Similarly, if you're building a house, the building materials would be comprised, would be the material cause that is part of the explanation of how the house came to be. The atomist tended to think of this material cause as being kind of a division of things to their smallest part, which couldn't be divided anymore. That has not necessarily held up to modern atomic theory, or much less quantum theory, that there is. But nevertheless, even in quantum theory, there is a substratum, but it's thought of in terms of a quantum field or a quantum foam, quantum fluctuation, but that nevertheless is the basis out of which all the other things arrive. He took this notion of cause from his study of the pre-Socratics. One thing Aristotle did is try to categorize all of the Greek philosophy up until his time, and he looked back at Thales, credited with being the first philosopher who said everything is composed of water, and then another pre-Socratic said, no, everything's made of air, and another one said everything's made of something called the unlimited, and Aristotle said they're on to something, but that's not the only answer. We'll call that material cause, but material cause by itself is insufficient to explain everything, but nevertheless it's part of the story. So another part of the story, Aristotle borrowed from his teacher Plato, who taught the doctrine of the forms as the perfect exemplar or essence of a thing that makes it what it is. For example, there would be an essence of a horse or an essence of a table, and all particular examples of tables or horses, or for that matter geometric figures like circles or lines or points, could be compared to the form of the idea as to how well they embody that form. But contrary to Plato, Aristotle did not believe, with three exceptions that are noted by Copleston, that a form is capable of existing in immaterial form. When you hear talk about Plato, sometimes you hear talk of this Platonic heaven, you know, where the Platonic forms sort of just kind of hover up there, Aristotle did not believe you could have a form except in union with the material cause, with the exception of what he called the unmoved mover, which was kind of the Aristotelian god, that is, a being who has no potential and is fully actualized, and because thought is the highest virtue, that the only activity of the unmoved mover is thought, and because the only thing worthy of the thought of a fully actualized being is itself, that the unmoved mover in Aristotle's theory spends eternity contemplating itself. That's kind of the Aristotelian god, if you would, which will be a form that's not materialized. Aristotle also had a notion of these celestial spheres. He did believe that the earth was round, but he believed that the planets and the stars moved in concentric circular spheres around the earth, and that they were guided by these intelligences. And in his psychology, he believed that there was part of the human soul that he called the active intellect, which is also an unformed part. But with those exceptions, the Aristotelian system, you'll never find a form except embodied in matter. And to Aristotle, science could only be about these universal abstract principles. If you wanted to study regularities, you had to study what was in common. If you were going to study horses, you had to you had to study horseness, and the fact that a particular horse might be white or spotted or black, you know, or Appaloosa or whatever was irrelevant detail, and science would only focus on the universal. And Aristotelianism, each form is the only member of its species, meaning that there's only one form of a horse, one form of a cat, one form of a dog, and you can have accidental occurrences. That's not saying that all dogs are identical, because some may be spotted, some may be, you know, long-tailed, some may be short-tailed, but insofar as they're a dog, there's only one kind of dog. And this made it difficult for Aristotelianism to accommodate Darwinian evolution, because there's really not any room in this system for kind of the in-between, you know, and forms in Aristotelian system do not mutate or gravitate into other forms. You know, something simply is its form, and there's really not any room for evolutionary development of forms. So some examples of formal cause would be, in the case of a sculpture, the form that the sculptor holds in his mind of what that sculpture is going to look like when it's finished, that's the formal cause of how the sculpture came to be. In the case of a house, it'd be the blueprint holding the design for the house. In the case of a living being, a plant or an animal, the formal cause is the potential for the development of that animal into its essence. In other words, the actualization of the potential of that animal or plant. Classic example of that is the acorn and the oak tree. The form of the acorn is the mature oak tree. And so the acorn, if not interfered with, will by natural process grow into that, in that oak tree. There's a notion in this formal cause that the growth, or the, let me say it this way, the actualization of the potential in that form is an unforced or a natural or a spontaneous change, you know, that tends to happen, at least in the case of these living beings. Now, in the case of the sculpture, the form is being imposed from the outside, but in the case of an internal formal cause, it naturally unfolds into what it has the potential to be. The notion of efficient cause, Aristotle thought was necessary to explain motion, because in the Aristotelian theory, he believed that the natural tendency of a substance was to be at rest. Now, Newtonian science would tell us that the natural tendency of a substance is inertia. If it's in motion, it will, without resistance, tend to remain in motion. If at rest, will tend to remain at rest. But Aristotle didn't have that notion yet. He just thought that quiescence was the natural state, and so you needed to explain motion by an efficient cause, a push, if you will, that kind of pushed the thing and set it in motion. And Aristotle did not think that his unmoved mover, his God, if you will, would serve as an efficient cause or a creator, because he thought that the need to create showed an efficiency that the unmoved mover could not have. And in other words, it would be an actualization of a potential not yet actualized. And in Aristotelian thinking, the unmoved mover was perfect actuality. And so there could be no creation or movement except a circular movement. The circular movement is kind of a perfect movement in the Aristotelian system, which is in this system what caused all those celestial spheres to rotate. So if you have an animal, then in this system, what causes the animal to move or causes propulsion is coincident with its formal cause, because it, it's not being pushed from the outside when it's moving on its own. It's moving under its own power or its own motive force. So these causes don't necessarily have to be different. In some examples, like the house, they are, but in others they can coincide. But if you have inanimate substances, like rocks or water or things like that, an external agent is necessary to contribute an efficient cause. And so therefore, the sculptor is the efficient cause of the sculpture. He takes the chisel and using the formal cause of the plan, produces the sculpture out of its material cause or the marble. Similarly, the constructors of the house take the formal cause of the architect, apply it to the material cause of the building materials, and cause the house to come into being. And this is very similar to the notion of mechanical causation. And so this particular cause of the four causes of Aristotle survived the transition to Newtonian physics the best. If you think of Newtonian physics as the classical example of the billiard balls on a table contacting each other and bouncing off of each other, then the movement, what gives puts those balls in motion, is the efficient cause. The composition of the billiard balls themselves, what makes them hard, that's their material cause. And in Newtonian physics, that was all that seemed to be necessary to explain phenomena is particles in motion, efficient cause imparting motion on particles. And then the one that Aristotle, the efficient cause, let me go back and say, he took that from Anaxagoras's concept of nous or mind, because Anaxagoras was another pre-Socratic who looked at the theorist of the material cause and said, well, they've reduced everything to one substance, but they haven't explained what moves that substance. And Anaxagoras's theory, it was the mind as the efficient cause, which caused the substance to move. And so Aristotle took that over from him. But Aristotle considered himself, probably rightly so, as the first to introduce in the history of Greek philosophy this notion of final cause to round out the four. And the final cause can be thought of as that for the sake of which, for example, a substance is set in motion. So if you go back to the house, I didn't put this on this slide, but we've been using the house example. The builders built the house in accordance with the architect's plan out of the building materials in order that some family would have shelter, or perhaps the builder himself would have shelter. That's for the sake of which the house was constructed. And Aristotle thought to explain the house, you needed to be able to explain, you know, really the why it was built, you know, as much as the, you know, what was pushing on it, what it was made of, what the design of it was, but you know, but what it was. And in the case of a plant, let's go back to the acorn. The final cause of the acorn is to grow into an oak tree, and that's kind of an internal cause. In the case of an animal, this gets modified a little bit with Darwinian natural selection, but the animal's purpose, you know, is both to grow and to reproduce and to survive in its environment. And so the formal makeup of the DNA will cause it to generate self-movement, and the final cause in the animal case is survival and propagation of progeny in the Darwinian model. But in the case of the human being, this was a special case to Aristotle because humans were the rational animal. And so a final cause in the case of the human being involved the use of the rational faculty to choose both the ends and the means to obtain those ends. And for Aristotle, it was all about obtaining happiness. But this is the Greek word, eudaimonia, which is not happiness as we would translate it being synonymous with pleasure or hedonism. To Aristotle, eudaimonia or happiness, he defined as activity in accordance with virtue. Why? Because in his system, the actualization of a human being was to actualize virtue, the same as the actualization of an acorn was to grow into an oak tree. But that did involve choices of the rational faculty to choose the ends to obtain virtue, and then secondarily the means to obtain the virtue. So, for example, if courage is defined as an Aristotelian virtue, then the human being would still have to determine, what he's going to be courageous about. Is it fighting the Spartans or the Persians? And if it's about fighting the Spartans or the Persians, then, what are the means to ends? Or if you become a hoplite, do you join the Navy? How do you demonstrate that courage? So we kind of already talked about Newtonian notion a little bit and how it rejected several notions of Aristotle, such as the idea that the natural tendency of a body is to remain at rest. Newtonian physics says no, the natural tendency is an inertial tendency. Aristotle believed that the four elements, earth, air, wind, and fire, had a natural tendency to sort themselves out in a certain order with earth at the bottom, and then water, and then air, and then fire. And that was how he explained gravity. Galileo's experiments showed that some of the things that would be true, such as gravitational, that the speed of falling would be faster or varying with the weight of the body, were not true. These notions of formal causation and final causation got temporarily thrown on the dustbin. But beginning with the start of the 20th century, some of these notions of formal cause began coming back in. They come out of the area having to do with embryogenesis or developments of embryos. For example, how does a single cell, say in a human embryo, differentiate itself into the different kinds of tissues and organs as cells divide to specialize in the different kind of tissues that make up the entire body? And prior to the 20th century, the explanation that most people had, scientists and non-scientists alike, was called preformationism, which is basically the notion that there's a tiny little organism in that single cell. When the cell divides, the organism just sort of parcels itself out, half goes here, half goes there, part goes here. But when they got to being able to stain and study cells, they found out that you couldn't find, this preformed, organism in the cell. And so they had to start looking for other ideas. And one of the other theories that emerged was called vitalism, which is that there's some kind of substance, some kind of protoplasm or élan vital or something like that, that's in life, that's not in other kinds of substances, causes these kind of things to happen. But some of these notions grew out of vitalism, but soon outstripped vitalism and kind of left it behind, in the sense that they didn't necessarily make a distinction between living substance and non-living substance, because once all of the complex hydrocarbons and DNA and all that were discovered, was no longer tenable to posit this sort of special life chemical. You know, we now know that the chemicals in life are the same chemicals, you know, that we can find in the pre-living world. So, starting with a fellow named Hans Driesch in the early 1900s, he went back and grabbed an Aristotelian word, which is this entelechy here, and basically what it means is an interior motivation toward an end, to realize a purpose or a goal. And Hans Driesch said the way we explain the development of embryos is by postulate of a non-mental causal factor that directs physical processes towards self-contained ends or goals. You know, this problem is maybe harder than it sounds, you know, at first blush, because, you know, they've done studies on things like flatworms, for example, and you can cut a flatworm in half, and each half of the flatworm will generate an entire worm. And so if you simply had division, and one half was going to be the top half of the worm and one was going to be the bottom half, then you wouldn't expect to have both halves, you know, be able to come out of it. And there's other examples of starfish and sea urchins and all kinds of other creatures that have shown this ability, you know, to regenerate lost parts of this division process in the division. And to a certain extent, that's what's behind the human stem cell research, is that you have these cells that are not yet differentiated, are therefore still able to, you know, to differentiate themselves into different adaptations. And so a lot of these words got coined in the 20th century. The scientists have always had this aversion to a perfectly good Greek word called teleology, which basically means that there's some purpose or end that things might be directed to. And so much so that they coined another word, teleonomy, when they had to try to explain indirect adaptations that an organism made. Another word that's common to integral theory and some of this tradition is the concept of a holon, which is the notion of a whole which is simultaneously part of a larger whole. Think about a liver cell. Well, let's think about the liver, which is part of a human body, but composed of liver cells. And then the liver cells themselves are composed of molecules, which are composed of atoms. And so you get this nested hierarchy, which is called a holarchy. And this introduces a notion of a multi-level organization where more inclusive levels are able to introduce what are called emergent properties that are not explicable in the description of the lower level. And then finally, the word morphic is just the Greek for form. And so a morphic unit is a unit of formal organization. It's something that you know, that gives form to an organism. So all these words began to be bandied about by various developmental biologists in the 20th century. Wait on that slide for a minute. Gives rise to a notion in its further development that Rupert Sheldrake refers to as morphic resonance. And the concept of morphic resonance is that, first of all, that these processes of differentiation and development are best explained by the idea of a field phenomena. And by field phenomena, we mean something similar to what's used in the description of electromagneticism, electromagnetic field. They had a real hard time explaining electricity until they came up with this concept of a field as opposed to a transmission of particles or substances in an electrical flow. Similarly, in the description of gravity, the notion of a gravitational field, which general relativity defines as a curvature in space-time, is a useful way to think of that. And perhaps this field concept, albeit a different kind of field, we're not talking about electromagnetic field or gravitational field, but this field concept might have utility in explaining what it is that causes that organism to unfold in a particular way. And although this notion of a morphic field has some interrelation with the concept of the DNA, the information contained in the DNA, it's thought to be a little bit more than just the DNA, because every cell has the same DNA regardless of what specialization it takes in the organism. And so, there may need to be something besides the DNA that takes cells with exactly the same genetic material and directs how they organize, in a field to take particularly different roles. And then the further notion of resonance between these morphic fields is the idea that in most fields, when there is a particular state in a field, that it will tend to propagate itself into an adjacent similar field. In other words, a vibration of a string in a stringed instrument will set crystal in a glass vibrating at the same frequency that the string is vibrating. Set of gases and one set of temperature is set next to a bundle of gases at another temperature that they will influence each other toward. One will be, the colder one will become hotter, the hotter will become colder. Some other examples. In a heat transfer, it was originally thought that there must be some kind of physical substance called caloric for when you put a hot substance, when you put a hot stove on a table to transmit that heat to the table. Now it's understood that there's a field of movement of the molecules, that the heat is defined as faster movement of molecules, and that faster movement propagates itself, in a wave manner into the surrounding substance. So the hypothesis of Sheldrake is that these morphological fields also have capability to propagate themselves in other adjacent organisms and to a certain extent in their descendants as well as their population mates. And that this may explain why DNA tends to gravitate around particular speciation and not spend as much time exploring the in-betweens, sort of the gaps, if you will. Most of those gaps being fatal to the survival of the individual, although some of those mutations are necessary to move evolution forward. Okay, so that's an illustration of how the notion of formal cause is coming back in. So one notion of formal cause is this notion of a field that gives form to a developing and growing organism. A second notion of formal cause comes from the similarity between the idea of form and information. Our concept of information, I think intentionally utilizes that root word of form, and the information is what is able to be accessed about, in the case, let's just look at the case of DNA, that in an organism, even if the DNA can't explain everything about how that embryo develops, the DNA does have information encoded in it, and that information is ultimately about the expected environment that the organism built after the pattern or recipe of that DNA is going to have to attempt to survive in. Why? Because Darwinian selection tells us that the DNA that doesn't contain useful information about the environment is not likely to be propagated and to survive. So the second meaning of formal cause is information that tells the bearer of that information, it gives them better than random chance of achieving, in this case, a purpose of survival and reproduction. That if all of the organisms just had sort of random selections of genetic material, their chances of being able to make it in whatever environment they are would be very nil. But because they have the information in their genes that is coded for success in the environment, that, you know, there's a decent chance they're going to survive and live to have offsprings. A third meaning, a formal cause, that Terence Deacon brings out is a little bit more subtle. But it has to do with this notion that Aristotle had, that materials had a natural tendency to remain at rest, and in particular the earth would be at the bottom, the water and all that. Although Newton told us the natural tendency is inertial tendency, to remain in motion once in motion, Einstein gave a corollary to that and said the reason why an object in orbit around the Earth doesn't, by operation of entropy, just sort of run down and eventually, you know, stop, is that motion around the Earth is actually the same thing as this inertial motion in a straight line, except it's in a curved field, in a curved gravitational field. And so what all these have in common is that they are an unforced, spontaneous state for that thing to be in. It was just understood differently by Aristotle at rest, Newton, uniform motion, Einstein, motion in a curved gravitational space field. It's still the natural state of that inorganic particle. And that could be thought of as the formal cause, in the sense that that's the, you know, the natural end, if you will, of that particular substance. The same way that the natural end of the acorn is to grow into the oak, the natural end of a species in Darwinian selection is to survive and reproduce, and the natural end of a human being, according to Aristotle at least, is to exercise rational faculties in the pursuit of virtue. So I want to turn now then from formal cause to final cause, which is the other one that tended to be neglected in the Newtonian paradigm. And I couldn't pick a lot of quotes from Terence Deacon, but here's one to get you a little bit of a taste for his ideas. He says, such concepts as information, function, purpose, meaning, intention, significance, consciousness, and value are intrinsically defined by their functional incompleteness. They refer to something non-present, which nevertheless has causal effect. And this is the notion that Terence Deacon says really comes back to Aristotle's notion of final cause, in the sense that there is something, as he says, non-present. He even coined the term absential features for these things, you know, features which are absent, but nevertheless have causal effect. Now, this is an echo back to Aristotle's notion of potentiality. Aristotle talked not only about what was actual, but what was potential. Aristotle had another word called privation, that the privation of an entity from actualizing its potential actually could have causative effect. And Deacon likens this in his book to the discovery of zero in mathematics. He says in mathematics for a long time, zero was considered sort of occult and taboo because you can't, you know, count to zero on your fingers or anything like that. So, you know, it's literally a non-natural number. But when zero was introduced to mathematics, it became more powerful by use of a signifier to something which is not present, you know, i.e. the null set. Deacon's notion is that similarly, these kind of concepts he talks about here, although they are signifiers pointing to a referent which does not have simple location in space or time, that they can nevertheless have causal effect. There's a lot I could draw out on this. It's a very complex treatment that Deacon gives in here, but let me see if I've got time for this part of it. So if you look then at causation in the modern scientific environment, what scientists tell us is that the true substratum or the true material cause is this quantum fluctuation or this quantum foam. And in the quantum fluctuation, you have particles of matter and antimatter that are arising and annihilating themselves instantaneously. But at some points, the symmetry of the particle and its antiparticle gets broken such that particles are allowed to have a duration and to exist, and that in our universe, the particles that have duration are particles with electrons of a negative charge and not antiparticles with positrons instead of electrons, but that was just kind of luck of the draw. And the quantum phenomena that emerge have this probabilistic nature, that you can specify the probability of a location, but you can't specify an exact location. But when you have quantum phenomena interacting with each other, you have what's called coherence, which is that the particles in their interaction with each other cause themselves to have to take a definite position. This is sometimes understood as you need a human observer to quit the particle into its location. I'm not of the belief that's the best explanation, that it can be just two quantum particles colliding without any human interaction, but they will necessarily specify themselves. But what you have happening here is what is natural and spontaneous in the quantum system, i.e. probabilistic distribution, at the classical mechanical level, becomes overridden by the supervenience, is the word used, of the classical level now has supervened on the quantum reality, and now we have Newton's billiard ball universe, where actions and reactions, every action has an equal and opposite reaction, and everything is predictable by the velocity and position of the particles. However, in Newtonian physics, all of the equations are time reversible, that there is no arrow of time. You know, if two billiard balls collide and you took a picture of them, you couldn't tell whether it was taken in reverse time or real time, because the collision would look the same. But you start putting 10 million billiard balls in an environment together, or 10 million gas molecules, and by the second law of thermodynamics, the tendency is that any difference in the position of those balls will even out and average out by the law of large numbers, such that the condition we call entropy, which is the absence of the ability to do work, because work implies a difference in some quality from one place to another. And so in the thermodynamic world, where there's an arrow of time, if you run a picture of an egg falling off of a table and splattering, and you run a picture of that egg in reverse coming up from the floor back to the table, you don't have any trouble telling which one's the real time and which the actual. But that is composed of a number of Newtonian interactions, all of which are equally reversible in time. So you have a supervenience of scale, and what is natural or spontaneous, or what Deacon calls orthograde at one level, becomes what he calls contrograde or forced, which is really the notion of Aristotle's efficient cause at a higher level. And so in Deacon's model of causation, you can operate on a lower level to make it move in a way that appears contrograde to its natural tendency at that level, but actually is not contrograde at all at the level above it. An example of that would be Darwinian evolution as a higher level than thermodynamic dissipation, because living organisms are dissipative systems that have, through the information coded in their DNA about their environment, have developed a system, what Deacon calls an entropy ratchet, to, at their local level, move in a contrograde direction from entropy and to actually order their ability to do work. Now, that's not to say you can reverse entropy, you know, universe-wide, but at the local level, life forms have discovered the ability to reverse the direction of entropy. At the mental level, beyond the biological level, we have the ability to propose these counterfactuals or hypotheticals or things that can actually reverse the direction that the statistical tendency of Darwinian survival would tend to lead to. You know, we can actually control our own population. We can control, to a certain degree, our environments in ways that other animals can't do. So this to Deacon is a use of the concept of final cause, but he uses it in a very non-supernatural, a very naturalistic way. A lot of the allergy of scientific thinkers to teleology or final cause has to do with this suspicion that somehow a supernatural agency is going to be smuggled into it. Deacon is of the view that it's possible to make room for these concepts such as purpose and meaning without necessarily, it's just a matter of the organization of work. Deacon notes the similarity between the concept of work at a mechanical level and the concept of work at a mental level. The concept of work is not well understood, but it's not the same thing as energy, because the first law of thermodynamics is that energy is conserved. And so, you know, we think of using up energy. We don't actually use up energy. We use up the ability of energy to do work. What causes the ability of energy to do work? Well, this differentiation in states, which is contrary to the direction of the second law of thermodynamics, that's what lets it do work. And so work is an effort that pulls the spontaneous orthograde movements away from their natural, their natural instinct in a particular direction, which is very similar to what Aristotle calls efficient cause. So to kind of put these together then and wrap up, this diagram is from Steve McIntosh's book, Evolution's Purpose. And I've got a slightly different one here, but this is the one that I'll show you next. This is the one McIntosh came up with. He puts the four causes on a grid with the y-axis being a distinction between what he calls physical causes. These were the two that Newtonian physics found room for, and metaphysical causes, the two that they really pretty much didn't. And then potential and actualization on the x-axis, meaning that efficient cause is an actualization of the material, final is an actualization of the formal. I think that's a somewhat useful diagram, but I came up with another one. I would actually put the potential and actual axis on the y, because I think it's more Aristotelian that the formal cause, the realization of the pattern design, the actualization of the potential in a material cause. And I think these two have to do with the interiors of, let's call them substances, to be Aristotelian, what the substance is intrinsically in itself, reflexively, and passively without interaction with other substances. That is what Aristotle taught, that substance is a union of the material cause and the formal cause. But when that substance starts to interact with other substances in an environment, then I think you have these extrinsic or expressive or active qualities. And the efficient cause is something that literally pushes on this material cause from outside its environment. It's what we were talking about when we were talking about the different levels, that it engenders this non-spontaneous or retrograde change in the material, and is work, in the sense we just described, applied to disrupt the equilibrium of the natural here, that's an efficient cause. But a final cause, if a formal cause is a potential that's actualized to a point in time, then a final cause, I would submit, is a potential yet to be actualized. In other words, not present in Deacon's term, his absential features. And that you could understand final and efficient as causes outside the substance, acting on the substance, material and formal being the activity of the substance itself. I'll close with an example that that Deacon uses to illustrate. He kind of starts and ends with this in his book to illustrate his point. He says if you were trying to explain, if you're on a beach and you see a smooth rock on the beach, and you try to explain how it got there, you know, it might have got there through years of erosion and you know, rocks being eroded and wave action bringing it up on the shore. But it might have gotten there because a little boy, I think he's talking about his own son in this instance, selected the rock to be a particular shape because he thought it would exhibit a quality of skipping across the water, and threw the rock across the water. And he said, you know, in the second case, you could explain the cause of the rock being where it is by transmission of nervous energy to the boy's muscles, you know, maybe what he had for breakfast that morning, maybe the evolution of humans to evolve a shoulder that can throw, you know, over time, and all of these kind of things. But is that really the explanation, you know, that really explains why that rock got there? You know, or is the explanation have to do with something of the the interior experience that the boy got from watching the rock, his own idea in his mind about what kind of rocks skip better than other rocks on the water. Therefore, he selected this rock instead of a rock with a slightly different shape. And he says, going back maybe a year before, when the father took his boy to another beach and he saw a rock skipped on the water for the first time, if you try to explain that in a normal mechanistic stage of cause, that seems so remote. You know, that was a year ago in an entirely different place. You know, how could that have mechanically caused? And so Deacon's thesis is that the absential features, that is, you know, the boy's mental picture about what a proper skipping rock looked like, his own desire to see the rock skip across the water, and those kind of factors are, in fact, very natural explanations of how the rock came to be where it is. And, you know, we shouldn't try to kid ourselves that we need to reduce it all to some sort of efficient, you know, kind of material causation to explain what we're seeing. So I'll close there and take a few questions.
All right, well, we have about 15 minutes for questions, and we kind of have a process that we've used over the years, and that's that I will call on someone who raises their hand, and we request that you please keep your prefatory commentary to a minimum, and that you get to the crux of your question very quickly, because other people have questions just like you do. But we do have to also have time to wrap up and leave by 9 o'clock, so that's 15 minutes is about the amount of time that we have. So who has the first question?
I don't need that. While everybody else is thinking of a question, I'm interested in your educated opinion. You're a philosopher and you're also a lawyer, so let's leave religion out of this altogether. But which argument do you think is more consistent with Aristotle's philosophy? That fertilized egg is a person under the Constitution, or fertilized egg is a potential person and not a person under the Constitution, given what you lectured on today?
Well, interesting question. It would have to do with what Aristotle understood, you know, a fetus to be, you know, given a human being. And actually, I don't know if you happen to be here, but we had a lecture by a professor from SMU, I believe, about this concept of ensoulment. Actually,
let's leave religion out of it.
Yeah, well, I mean, but that's how they were applying Aristotelian concepts.
And, okay.
And it would have to do whether, you know, a human being was formally, in the Aristotelian sense, a human being when it's a single cell or a blastosphere, or whether it's only, you know, a human being at viability. And frankly, I don't know the answer to, if you just had Aristotle's works to go on, where you would make that call.
Which argument is more consistent with his philosophy or reason?
Yeah, I don't know that he spent a lot of time thinking about, you know, fetuses, but I haven't read, you know, certainly all of Aristotle, and he might have ventured into that grounds, but I'm sorry, I just can't.
No, that's fine.
I can't handle that.
All right, we have a question right here.
You need the mic.
Give it to him anyway.
Quick comment is, I'm not sure if teleonomy would be the same concept as the holarchy in Wilbur's integralism as you're referring to. I think there's somewhat different aspects, although he does refer to the concepts of end goals in the system. I have two questions. One is, how much is the concept of teleonomy, or final goals, now becoming popular in both philosophy of science and in science in general? And my second question is, given the fact that Aristotle's unmoved mover is fully actualized, but not able to be the efficient cause of existence, and given the fact that he does not believe in the infinite retrospective time, hence therefore the world is, in that sense, somewhat a little finite, is who is its creator, or how does the world come to be then in our story?
Okay. Let me take those one at a time. I appreciate your reference to integral theory. That's actually my number one, you know, favorite worldview, so didn't happen to be the subject tonight, but you're right. I mean, there is a difference between holons and holarchy and entelechy, although Wilbur does use the concept of entelechy, you know, to explain some of his notions in SES. Let's see, the second question was about Aristotle's how creation happened. The question before that was
The coming, the resurgence of
the... Oh, yeah, final cause in science. Yeah, theology in science. Well, I still think it's very kind of, what's the right word, cutting edge, or kind of, in my opinion, from what I've read, most scientific writers still feel that the subject of teleology, you know, perhaps even teleology, is kind of off limits, because I think they think it's non-naturalistic. But I think there's a little bit of thaw with people like, you know, Deacon is very much naturalistic in his approach. And draws on a lot of secondary materials that I didn't have time to point out. And other people like Stuart Kaufman, I don't know if you're familiar with him, with the Santa Fe Institute, has talked about some of these notions of ends or purposes as well. So I guess the way I characterize it is it's sort of maybe just starting to break the ice to be an acceptable subject to scientific discourse, but it's still kind of way out ahead. And in fact, I didn't really run down this reference, but I was talking to somebody in advance of this talk, and they told me that Rupert Sheldrake, who's the author of one of these, was actually temporarily banned from coming back for a TED talk, that he had given a TED talk about some of these ideas, and I don't know what he said, but I also understand that ban was later reversed. Were you on tell me that, Jack?
No.
And then final question was Aristotle's notion of creation. As I understand it, Aristotle just believed that the physical universe was eternal in existence and had no beginning in time and needed no beginning in time. So there's not really a concept of creation in there at all. You know, there's just a concept of potential, you know, that wants to be actualized, so to speak.
But is there actual movement in the potentiality? I mean, are things actually going up, or are they kind of stuck in their Sisyphean sort of this struggle to just, that's, you know, the great chain of being again? Is there an actual being there? Or is it act like a new Platonism? You have this idea of, you know, the man, the rational self, not going up all the way to be, you know, joining with the active intellect. Is that a concept that's similar in Aristotle? Is just everybody's pretty much back to where they are?
Well,
unique form that they've taken.
Yeah, I mean, I think he believes in that potential wants to actualize and has a tendency to actualize if there's no impediment in its way. And I think he would say that in the case of a human being, that really consists of having a contemplative life, meaning that, you know, you're able to think about these, about philosophy and these kind of causes. And so that's probably as close as Aristotle gets to a, you know, kind of concept of heaven, you know, would be, I don't think it's an afterlife concept at all. It's that of a perfected human being who has, you know, been able to you know, actualize the rational animal by thinking rational thoughts, you know, at all times.
Okay, next question right over there.
Yeah, I was wondering, I just going back 10 or 15 years when I read this article about Rupert Sheldrake, but are you aware of the fact that he had posited sort of a theory that he wasn't just saying sort of like a neo-Lamarckian thing about rats, you know, you put a rat in a maze and maybe its children have learned something from it. It's now been determined that neo-Lamarckianism does have some justification in the epigenetic layer itself, but I think he was going further than that, saying that other mice, not related to it, or not even in the same city, were somehow learning from other mice as though they were in some sort of general projected field by the Almighty or the adventure of mice or something like that. I can easily see that he was really positing what I thought this article was saying. He was saying, why would he be banned from lecturing and scientific.
Yeah, he does talk about notions like that in this book, The Presence of the Past. You know, it's the idea of morphic resonance can be taken a lot of different ways. But I mean, one of the ways that he does, I mean, he presents it not as like I've proven this, but it's kind of like a speculative a particular morphic field could, you know, the same way that sound vibrations have a resonance of other vibrations could have a resonance. And so I think he would at least exploratorily apply it to things like, you know, human, you know, cultural ideals and things, you know, that they could have a resonance, you know, in other brains. And yeah, that may be what he was banned for, but he's doing it speculative. I don't think he's doing it dogmatically.
All right, we have another question right here.
Yeah, my understanding of that morphic field, I think a lot about Tara Desjardins' noosphere and even the collective unconscious, you know. I think of it kind of like that. But my question, David, I know in the evolution purpose, Steve talks about the intrinsic values of the good, the true, and the beautiful. Were those concepts around, and that rubric, was that around when Aristotle was doing his values thinking, and did he include that, do you know?
Well, it's Platonic, so it definitely was around, because Plato was his direct teacher,
right.
And you know, Plato explored beauty in the Symposium, and good in the Republic, and you know, and so that's where we get those ideals from. I don't think Aristotle made use of them in exactly that form. He had more of a theory of virtues, and virtues for him were like a mean between two opposite vices. You know, for example, courage is intermediary between rashness and cowardice, and so I think he thought in terms of you know, actualization of virtues through rational choice. And he did talk about things like poetics and tragedy and things like that, but I don't know that he had the same kind of, he wasn't as into these transcendental ideals as Plato was. That's more of a, but the ideas were around, but he just didn't particularly gravitate that direction.
All right, we have time for one more question, or maybe two. Very quick.
Perhaps instead of saying virtue, you could translate the Greek word arete into English, being excellence. It makes it better because what it's really talking about is the most optimal behavior in any given circumstances. It makes more sense as opposed to looking at the word that virtue may be used in a more abstract form.
Good point. We can confuse virtue. It's kind of like a deontological, like deontic, you know, this is the rule, but his was more like you say, an excellence of what it means to be a human being.
Okay, we have a question over in the back.
Yeah, I've got one question. If you wait, don't ask the first, I'll defer to them. I can do Congress by time. If you have a question back there? Okay, my question is sort of personal, David. I think if most of us in this room relate to your curiosity about the relevance of something historical, you've been on your journey. You've obviously done a lot of work. You've watched your books. You used the new terminology. As a practical matter, as a question, does that have just a brain exercise, intellectual curiosity satisfied, or does it have relevance to your work as a lawyer?
Yeah. That's an interesting question. I mean, I'm sure it has some relevance in the sense that here's the way I think about that, this was actually as part of another talk I gave on Saturday, but if you think of this kind of theory on the analogy of a computer's operating system, then my law practice, and for that matter, my, you know, role as a husband, are all their applications that run on top of that theory, I mean, that operating system. And what operating systems do is let you connect applications to other applications and use data out of one into another. And so in that sense, I would hope that, you know, what I'm able to develop from satisfying philosophical curiosity would, you know, make the application of law 3.0 or whatever, you know, a little bit more effective.
Yeah.
But it's a little bit indirect. I mean, it's just like if you got a new version of Windows, how it might make your Outlook run might be a little indirect. But that's what happens. Thank you very much.
All right, David, thank you very much for speaking to us.